You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about last week's secondary school teacher strike and New Zealand joining over 20 other countries in calling for immediate and independent foreign media access into Gaza. I spoke to Dr. Natalie Forsdyk, the president of Bird New Zealand, about a new study showing birds are singing almost an hour later due to light pollution. And I also spoke to Dr. Rashi Parker, the fundraising manager of Bird Care Aotearoa, a native bird hospital based in West Auckland, about what she is seeing at the hospital and about the wider impacts of light pollution on our birds. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to the Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Otago, Leah Watkins, about a recent study showing the extent to which children are exposed to junk food, alcohol and gambling marketing, and why and how we should regulate. I also spoke with Senior Lecturer in the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, Bill Mackay, about the Council's vote to make changes to housing density rules in the Auckland Unitary Plan and how it will affect Aucklanders.
Kia aho whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware, e ahei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei a pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o Irinangi Pōho, me Heidi Ki, 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, up to 19,000 secondary school teachers across the Motu went on strike for a day over what they say is an inadequate pay offer of 1% each year for 3 years by the Ministry of Education. The union, the Post-Primary Teachers Association, or PPTA, say this pay offer is the lowest in a generation. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the strikes and the ministry's pay offer. We also discussed New Zealand joining 26 other countries in calling for immediate and independent foreign media access into Gaza and to allow Israel to protect journalists reporting from within the besieged strip. The joint statement by the Media Freedom Coalition says journalists and media workers play an essential role in putting the spotlight on the devastating reality of war. Access to conflict zones is vital to carrying out this role effectively. We oppose all attempts to restrict press freedom and block entry to journalists during conflicts. I also spoke to court about this, but first, we discussed last week's secondary school teachers' strikes. 1% is not a lot. What is the basis for such a low offer, and are you in support of this offer?
Well, this offer is made by the Ministry of Education to the teachers. It's not a government offer. But I will point out that teachers have received a 14% pay increase over the past 3 years. They also get 12 weeks annual leave, which is in stark contrast to the modest gains that most taxpayers and workers have had in their pay packets over that time frame. So it does appear pretty unreasonable that teachers have decided to go on strike over their pay offer, given where they're at. You know, there's got to be a bit of context around that. And yeah, they're also getting additional support in the classroom because the government's allocated a lot more money for teacher aides in the last budget. So, you know, on balance, I would say that, you know, 6 days of negotiations and then hiving off to have a strike does seem pretty unreasonable.
Speaking of those additional sort of things teachers do need, with the cost of living crisis making it harder to afford basic necessities, not just for teachers but for everyone, and these teachers potentially having to help implement the government's proposed education curriculum that would take over NCA, an ageing workforce and shortages in the sector, wouldn't such a low pay offer by the Ministry of Education be unenticing for teachers, especially for new younger teachers who may be more inclined to actually work overseas over better pay offers offers and better working conditions?
Oh, look, all of these things need to be in the mix when an employer is considering how to attract and keep talent. And so you're absolutely right. But of course, the other things that an employer needs to balance is what can they afford? And given that education has 2,500 or so properties, tens of thousands of buildings which require long-term maintenance, which has been underfunded for so many years, and where school boards haven't had the capability to actually manage their own property maintenance. Of course, there's improving literacy and numeracy outcomes. There will be some changes to the NCA structure coming. All of these things take time and cost money. So balancing how much money you've got and then what you can allocate it to is going to be absolutely vital to make sure that we get the settings right. Teachers' pay is just one of these matters.
A New Zealand Post-Primary Teachers Association spokesperson has said that more mediated bargaining between the ministry and the union will occur today and tomorrow. I guess this is a bit too early to say, but would you imagine this offer may change for teachers, or will the ministry stand strong on their current offer?
Well, I certainly wouldn't speculate on a bargaining strategy by a government agency. That would be completely inappropriate. But I think I've set out some of the things that education as a department needs to be thinking about in terms of what budget it has, how much it can offer its employees. And I'll also say it's great that teachers have returned to mediation. I mean, some of these things take a while to work out, to really understand the other party's positions, to listen to understand. And, you know, going on strike after 6 days, as they did last week, seemed pretty unreasonable at the time. So, you know, I just encourage teachers and, you know, those listening to the show today just to be thinking about, you know, let's make sure we're listening to each other, understand what the long-term project is for education in New Zealand, getting us back to, you know, this kind of standards, educational standards that we were achieving, you know, 20 to 25 years ago at the start of the century, and that's the project.
On to our next topic. New Zealand has joined 26 other countries in calling for immediate and independent international media access into Gaza. This follows an Israeli strike killing 6 Al Jazeera media workers in Gaza City earlier in the month, with Israel's war on Gaza resulting in the deaths of over 200 media workers over the past 22 months. How does the ACT Party feel about these deaths?
Well, I think it's awful when people in the line of their work, whether they be medical professionals or humanitarian workers or journalists, are killed in a conflict zone. I also think it's important to be absolutely clear that the only journalists who have been working in the Hamas-controlled areas of Gaza where these fatalities and injuries have occurred have been there with the support and approval of Hamas. In many cases, their reporting has not just repeated Hamas propaganda lines, but some of these individuals, including at least one of those killed in that Israeli strike, had posted in support of Hamas's terror attacks on Israel and the murder of civilians on October 7. And they had been seen on many occasions in the company of Yahya Sinwar and other senior Hamas leaders, and not wearing a press vest. So, you know, I think it's really important that we keep this in context, because in the end, you know, the truth will come out. Right now, we're really only hearing from Hamas-approved journalists, if that's what they are, in Gaza.
Speaking more to those accusations, as you just said, the journalist that I think that you're referring to, Anas al-Sharif, Israel claimed as being affiliated with Hamas. However, Mohammed Shahada, an analyst at the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, said there was zero evidence of this. Could this not just be Israel justifying their killing of Anas al-Sharif and all these other journalists in the Gaza Strip?
Well, I have seen images which clearly link that individual to Yahya Sinwar, and also to the posts that he put up on social media in the days following October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas. So, look, there may be differing views on the quality of that evidence, but again, we're sitting here in New Zealand speculating about these matters. I think what is really important, and I that's why I support the New Zealand government's position, is that at the moment it's not possible to get different sides of the story or different opinions about what's going on inside Gaza within the Hamas-controlled area. So I think it would be really helpful to have some independent journalists, people you know who work for some of those networks that have been investigating reports coming out of Gaza and Lebanon, you know, around the attacks that Hezbollah were also planning around October 7. You know, if we could get some more of that information out into the public domain to balance this constant Hamas-supporting narrative we see in our mainstream media, I think it would be really helpful, and I would encourage the Israelis to respond along those lines.
Speaking more to what you were just saying and about New Zealand's calls for more immediate and independent international media access into Gaza, would you want this to include maybe New Zealand journalists on the ground in Gaza? And how would the government ensure in this case that these journalists wouldn't become another statistic? They wouldn't join the 200 other journalists that have been killed since October 7?
Well, New Zealanders work for all kinds of media organisations around the world, so I wouldn't be surprised if New Zealanders are covering what's going on in the Middle East right now from wherever they work, whether it's Qatar, if they work for Al Jazeera another capital. But of course, the New Zealand government can do very little to make sure that New Zealand citizens are safe in a war zone. Gaza is a war zone. Hamas attacked Israel on October 7. The Israeli government and its military have responded to that attack. And unfortunately for the civilians in Gaza that Hamas is hiding amongst, they are also at risk because of Hamas's actions. But Hamas doesn't care about them. In fact, they are part of its strategy. Civilian deaths, they're just shaheeds on the path to Hamas glory, which is establishing an Islamic state right on the borders of Israel. So New Zealand can't really do much to protect its own citizens, whether they're journalists or humanitarian workers, who are in that conflict zone.
Interestingly, New Zealand did not join countries such as Australia, the UK and Canada in denouncing Israel's plans to expand their presence in the West Bank. Why is this, and would you want New Zealand to join these calls instead?
Well, I don't think right now that it's helpful to be focusing on what you might say are over-horizon political issues, like declaring a Palestinian state, for example. It's quite irrelevant to the situation that Israel is facing and that the international community could be and should be trying to help work out, which is how on earth do we get the last 20 remaining hostages who may be alive out of the clutches of Hamas? How does that happen without endangering the lives of so many civilians that Hamas is hiding behind? How is Hamas disarmed? And whatever administration takes over Gaza does not become a new and even more dangerous threat to the people of Israel and its neighbours Jordan and Egypt, who signed long-term peace treaties with Israel. All of these matters, I would say, are far more important and urgent than whether somebody is doing a housing development in the West Bank right now. So, that would be my perspective, and certainly I imagine there are many New Zealanders who would share my perspective.
That was the ACT Party Simon Court on last week's secondary school teacher strike over pay disputes and New Zealand's joining over 20 other countries in calling for Israel to allow international media access into Gaza.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, a study was published showing that children are exposed to unhealthy food, alcohol, and gambling marketing in some form 76 times a day on average. Academics at the University of Otago have called for restrictions on such marketing, as exposure to these ads for children has a negative impact on their health and well-being. I spoke to Associate Professor of Marketing Leah Watkins from the University of Otago about the study, how it affects Aotearoa's young people, and what the government should do about it. Can you walk us through this study?
Yeah, sure. So the study is based on wearable camera data. So we had 168 children in the wider Wellington region who wore these wearable cameras for a period of 4 days. And the cameras took an image every 7 seconds, so we could pretty much see everything in the children's immediate environment.
And what did the study show for what children are seeing?
So in this particular study, we were interested in looking at the unhealthy commodity. So what our wider study showed was actually that children see about 554 branded messages a day. And in this particular study, we then looked specifically around the unhealthy marketing that they were seeing. And what we found is that they are seeing messages for alcohol, tobacco, gambling, and unhealthy food 76 times every single day.
And how is this exposure affecting young people?
Yeah, so we know there is lots of empirical evidence that advertising does influence children's beliefs, behaviours, attitudes. We know that food advertising is associated with increased risk of obesity, that alcohol leads to earlier onset and more hazardous drinking, and that tobacco marketing leads to earlier smoking initiation. So there's lots of research showing the dangers. And so we were looking at what is the scale and scope of it.
And is there a reason that we should be particularly worried about the exposure for children to things like alcohol and gambling before they're able to legally access these activities and products, or is it kind of a wider concern?
Yeah, I think that the concern really with advertising of any sort is that it normalises behaviours. So even though the children are not able to purchase alcohol, it's already shaping their values and their understandings of what alcohol represents and what is, you know, what are behaviours they would emulate. So in that sense, it very much is still influential whether they can buy the products or not. But given that they can't, stopping advertising that is visible in their spaces or specifically that is targeting them online, we would like to see that stopped.
And have there been any recent trends about these products and their marketing that are particularly concerning?
There has been an escalation in how much advertising dollars are being spent on marketing to children. We know that on a global scale. But it's not just about how much is being spent. It's also the strategic expansion of how and where children are being reached. Obviously, you've got your traditional media, but of course, there are regulations around television, for example, for children. But what's happening is, more and more immersive digital and interactive environments where they are being targeted. And the other one that we saw a lot of in our study is neighbourhoods. And unfortunately, children living in the most deprived areas are exposed to significantly more of this type of marketing. And that is because of the high density of alcohol and fast food outlets in their communities.
Alcohol in New Zealand tends to have a kind of deep association with at least sports marketing. Mm. How is this a particular worry?
Yeah, sponsorship is, of course, a concern that children, they are passionate about the teams or the sports that they follow, and often you do see them sponsored by alcohol companies. Maybe it's a poster in their bedroom to do with a sports team, but also with the alcohol branding on it. So again, it's just reinforcing these positive brand associations that we know long-term are not good for them.
And is it of particular concern who is placing these ads and branding, whether or not it's Coca-Cola or TAB?
Yeah, well, what we found actually is Coca-Cola is indeed the single brand they see most, about six times a day. We looked at where the messages are coming from, and it is a small minority of multinationals that are responsible for the majority of this kind of marketing. So we looked at the top eight multinationals for food and the top eight for alcohol, and that explained over 50% of what kids were seeing. So, there is scope there to work with those multinationals, whether that's regulation and just looking at other ways that we can promote more positive messaging. The gambling one is very different, of course, because 97% of the gambling advertising that they see is from New Zealand Crown entities. So Lotto, TAB. So obviously the government could immediately look at introducing restrictions there.
We've seen tobacco marketing banned in New Zealand. Is there a reason that we couldn't and shouldn't do the same for all of these products?
Absolutely not. I think what our study showed is that regulation works. We didn't see any tobacco advertising of tiny amount for a couple of children. But, you know, it works. We know it works. Could we do the same? Certainly for alcohol and tobacco, yes. I think food is a little bit more difficult. But ultimately, you know, we have really high rates of obesity amongst our children, so we do need to do something quite radical.
And with that in mind, what sort of regulation do you want to see on these products?
What we are calling for is a move away from industry self-regulation, which is clearly not working to protect children. And what we'd like to see is a joint, coherent approach for all the unhealthy commodities. You know, given their shared characteristics and impacts and the fact that they are coming from a relatively small number of key players, we would like them treated as an unhealthy commodity industry. Basically, our evidence is that the systems are not protecting children and that we need stronger, more unified action from policymakers.
That was the University of Otago's Leah Watkins on children's exposure to marketing for unhealthy foods, alcohol and gambling.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
A musical journey awaits you at Frida Margolis with a performance of The Amber Temple. Creeping up and down your spine. Witness music and dance colliding as singer-songwriter Julian Temple and contemporary dancer Amber Stevens draw the audience into a world of mystery with curious characters and strange events. The Amber Temple, Frida Margolis in Grey Lynn, Sunday, August 31st, and at Sawmill Cafe, Saturday, September 6th. Pre-sales available now at Under the Radar.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No! Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Wallao Radio. 2 hours of music from Southeast Asia and its diaspora. Complete with spicy takes, close inspections, interviews, and everything in between. Hey. She wanna miss slide, that's why she got that.
Wallao Radio, Monday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Brought to you by your hosts, Otto and JC. Only on 95BFM.
Wallawe!
West Coast. Chopping.
Regan, wake
East
up.
West Coast.
Honey,
on
you're
shore.
Having those strange nightmares. Oh, no! No, it's not!
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Damien, it's happening again!
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
That song is Animistic Ritual by Fraunarts. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
A recent international study, including using recordings of birds in New Zealand's North Island, has shown that birds worldwide are singing for almost an hour longer due to light pollution. The study uses the audio recordings of millions of birds, and these findings show that light pollution confuses birds, impacting their natural cycles, and could have an impact on their health. I spoke to Dr. Natalie Forsdick, the president of Birds New Zealand, about these recent findings. I guess out of curiosity and for those who are unaware, what is the purpose of a bird's song?
So bird's song is what they use to communicate with one another. So it can be used to tell other birds in the vicinity that this is their territory, this is their area. It can be used to attract mates. It can be used to scare other birds off. And it can be used to communicate with chicks as well. So, you know, chicks do a lot of begging for food. They'll be sitting in their nest calling out to their parents. Yeah, so lots of different ways of communication.
What do these findings actually mean? Why is it concerning that birds are delaying their songs until almost an hour later?
By singing for an hour later during the day, it could mean a whole range of different things, and we're not quite sure. We see some impacts where it's an extra hour of very vigorous activity. So birdsong does cost energy. It does take this energy for them to be able to communicate. And that could have negative impacts because they're not able to put that energy into getting bigger and stronger or producing offspring. It could also mean that they're staying up later. And, you know, like we feel in the morning, if we've stayed up too late, we feel a little bit the worse for wear. Not quite the early bird catching the worm. It could be impacting their sleep cycles, so they may not be as well rested for the next day. And that could have impacts on how much energy they have to give, how able they are to go out and feed, and how they're able to look after their chicks. So there's a whole range of different impacts there. And I think the biggest thing is that the birds don't get a choice in the matter. We're the ones who have control of those lights. So it's a little bit like when you stay in a hostel and someone else in your room decides to fall asleep with the light on. I know that would make me be chirping and cheeping for sure, so I can definitely understand that it's not the best thing for our birds.
Are these findings similar to what we have seen from previous studies?
The impacts we're seeing from this study, it's a really great study because they've looked at so much data from around the world. When we look at what we know for New Zealand specifically, there's been around 20 different studies in the past that have looked at the impacts of light on birds. And it's been a mix of looking at birds that are typically awake during the day, like this study has. But we also have a number of birds in New Zealand that are awake during the night. And that can have different impacts on those birds. So especially for our seabirds, New Zealand is often known as the seabird capital of the world. And we've got a huge diversity of seabirds around our coastlines and offshore islands and onshore as well. And so we're interested to know what impacts there might be for those birds. Seabirds being typically nocturnal, they use the light of the moon and stars to guide them around. So they use the moon and stars to navigate. And sometimes they can get really confused by these urban lights, these big lit up centres. And it can cause them to fly into cities by accident. They can crash land. They might injure themselves if they fly into a building or something like that. And so we know that for seabirds in particular, this light at night can have really significant and severe impacts for them.
If we're looking towards the future a little, and if light pollution doesn't decrease, what could we be seeing with our bird populations, maybe specifically seabirds, because you did just mention that they are nocturnal. So what could we be seeing there?
So as light continues to be increasingly used around our urban centres, it becomes a real risk for those birds. So for a lot of our daytime birds, the birds that are awake during the day, we're not quite sure of what impacts it might have. So I talked a little bit about the negative impacts earlier. It might also have positive impacts because they're able to stay awake that little bit longer. They're able to keep doing their bird things a little bit longer so they can be out feeding, foraging, feeding chicks, meeting up with neighbours. So it could have potentially good impacts for them. but we just don't know the whole story at this point, and it can be really different for different bird species. So, for example, in New Zealand, we've got both native and introduced birds. It's possible that for some of our introduced birds, like starlings or sparrows, they might be a little bit better adapted to this light at night, and so they might not be so heavily impacted by it compared to some of our native birds that haven't evolved alongside this light at night. But, I mean, that's just all hypothetical at this stage. We still need a lot more data, a lot more studies to be done to find out what's really going on. And definitely, as light increases, you know, our urban centres are getting bigger. These impacts could be stretching out further away from our centres as well. So there's a lot of potential impacts there.
Would you then maybe recommend people reduce the amount of light they use if we're looking specifically towards the negative impacts of light pollution on our bird populations? And if so, how would you suggest people do so?
Yes, so I think every little bit counts on this front. You know, this artificial light at night is a real disruptive factor for nature, not just birds, but also it might be impacting insects or in places where they have a lot of native mammals, it could be impacting those as well. So every little thing we can do to help reduce the impacts of those lights can only help. So things that we could do, we could be turning off our outside lights when we're not using them. We could be thinking about closing the curtains or the blinds at night so that we're not letting that light from our houses escape out into the garden or onto the street. And we can be talking to our local businesses or councils about what they can do to help reduce that light as well. So we are seeing some really good mitigation strategies being put into place around the country. So despite the fact that we've seen an increase in the amount of light used as our urban centres become bigger and our population has been growing, we are seeing that councils are using different kinds of lighting that's more directed and is less likely to have those unintended impacts on our wildlife. Yeah, definitely strategies like that to help reduce that extra light that's being put out that we just don't need.
Following on from my chat with Forsdick, I also spoke to Dr. Rashi Parker, the fundraising manager at Birdcare Aotearoa, a native bird hospital based in West Auckland, about these findings, how light pollution is impacting the birds coming into the hospital, and what people can do to ensure birds are carefully transported to the hospital if needed. If we're looking at Birdcare Aotearoa, your hospital, what birds are commonly coming to your hospital?
We've got seasons where the effects of our bright artificial lighting across the city are very obvious, particularly over the autumn period where juvenile seed birds, many of them are rare and endangered or critically endangered species, and they are fledging in the Hauraki Gulf Islands or around some of our coastlines, and they should be out at sea and learning to fish and actually just about to embark on a giant voyage across the Pacific. But around April, starting in February this year, all the way to June, we had 100 TT Cook's petrels. They're a relict species, so only 10% of the original population. We also had 13 endangered Taikor black petrels. We had quite a few Buller's shearwaters, also endangered blue petrels, fulmars, Antarctic fulmars. These are birds that are not meant to be anywhere near land. So there's something drawing them, these young juveniles in particular, into the city. And the problem is they crash land into structures. So that's when people bring them in, they rescue these birds, find them under brightly lit towers or brightly lit infrastructure, and they bring them into care. And then we've got a hard job to rehabilitate them, recovering their injured wings. Some of them have head knocks and signs of collision. We've got to recover those and pain relief and then get them refed because they don't feed in captivity. Get them fed, hydrated, teach them how to swim again and actually get them back out to the wild.
Have you seen an increase in these bird species being impacted by light pollution, having to come to the Birdcare Aotearoa Bird Hospital in maybe the past few years even?
That's a really great question, Joel. We've got a data set that starts in about 2018 is when our digital records start. And what we see is obviously during COVID, there weren't that many rescues coming into the hospital, but certainly 21, 22, 23, 24, and this year 25, we've just had a huge climb. And so in terms of the rescues we've seen so far, We have 147 birds in care. Our current is a young oi, a grey-faced petrel who was rescued from the Henderson concourse. And yeah, there's certainly a climb, and we see that a really cool article working with our collaborators at the University of Auckland shows a correlation between the sites of rescue and actually the brightness of the sky, the night sky. There seems to be a very strong correlation there.
And you've briefly touched on this, but what are the symptoms that a bird has been impacted by light pollution specifically? Is there anything people can look out for?
Yeah, so they come in with a whole range of symptoms. Some of them have what's called grounded. So they've obviously landed, but the way that their wing structure is, particularly these long-haul flyers, petrels and shearwaters, they actually need wind and elevation to take off. And certainly when you're stuck around city high-rises and infrastructure, it's really hard to get that to take off. So some of these birds are just grounded and unable to fly, and people have found them under car parks, under the towers, and on the streets, kind of hobbling around. So we see those birds with injured foot pads, broken sort of climbing thumbs that they need to climb, and actually because they've been walking on kind of that rough tarmac for so long, they've often got kind of bruised or injuries on their wings, on their elbow area. So that's some of the recoveries that we've got to do. And obviously head collisions are huge. We've also got starvation because they just can't take off to eat again. They're severely dehydrated. Again, they can't take off to drink. And the worst is actually they're more vulnerable to predation. So we don't even know the birds that get caught by backyard cats or other or get very injured out in the suburbs.
And overall, what would you suggest listeners do to reduce the amount of light they use, and even how to safely handle a bird if they need to bring the bird to Bird Care Aotearoa or another bird hospital in the country?
Joel, that's a really great question, and I really love it because you were here as one of our EcoFest bird rescues or bird heroes workshops earlier this year. Basically, it depends on the type of bird, and at the best is to call your local bird hospital or the Department of Conservation hotline, 0800 Doc Hot, which is on 24 hours, 7 days a week, and ask for advice based on that specific bird. But what we want to do is to get these birds into care without feeding them. So it's actually a very professional operation to feed and care for these birds. So if you could get those birds to a professional service as soon as you can, that generally involves gently collecting the bird with a towel and putting them in a dark and ventilated box. Do not feed them. Do not try to give them water, because that's actually almost, they can get very wet and get hypothermic by mistake. If they feed the wrong food, or if they can actually choke and really affect their well-being. So yeah, the best is to actually call the Doc Hotline, call Bird Care or your local native bird rescue, and we can give you species-specific advice. Obviously, for us, the seabirds who are affected by light pollution is a very clear intake. But we also get several birds that are more regular sort of backyard species, like ruru and tui. And the thing is, the impacts of artificial lighting on their well-being is still to be understood. A really beautiful study by the team at, I think, NMIT, Nelson and Marlborough Institute of Technology, they've actually done a big meta-analysis of birds that come through changes in the ecology of these birds. So, for example, ruru, they seem to be hunting under streetlights for longer. Tui seem to be, could be singing for longer. And even the spectrum of their song can change. And what that does to their well-being in terms of coming into care, we can't actually diagnose straight away, but we might see effects like birds who are not feeding because of their unusual feeding patterns. We might see chicks coming in off seasons because their breeding patterns are thrown off. Well, their seasonal breeding patterns are thrown off because of the changes in the light cues. We're a tiny charity and we're responsible for rehabilitating the majority of Auckland's bird life, native bird life. This year we estimated about 100k for our seabirds recovery program, but in reality, when it actually hit us, we found an excess of about $24,000 in staff overtime, sometimes working till 9 o'clock at night. We spent a fortune on seabird food, marinara, vitamin supplements for seabirds and gloves, even petrol for all the petrels the seabirds releases. We've been very grateful to have a huge amount of public support, some grants from Ports of Auckland, Pathfinder, GREE and the Hugh Green Foundation for really supporting that work. And we're really hoping for funding commitments from Sky City, who've also agreed to dim their lighting display intensities over those key migratory seasons, but would really like some additional financial support for it as well.
That was the president of Birds New Zealand, Dr. Natalie Forsdick, and the fundraising manager of Birdcare Aotearoa, Dr. Rashi Parker, on a recent study showing birds worldwide are delaying their bird song due to the impacts of light pollution. If you want to support the work Birdcare Aotearoa do, you can support them via their website, birdcarealtearoa.org.nz, the podcast version of this interview, available on the 95BFM website after the show, will have a link attached to donate.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Hey, walk a walk out. Follow me down. Hey, walk a walk out. Follow me down to my garden. Sunny morning, lying in bed. I'm thinking about what somebody said. Thinking about what they meant when they said it, and thinking I know what they meant. Thinking that they meant that I am lesser. Well, the garden's great for keeping thoughts like that away. Guess you could say it keeps me going to see what's growing. I get up, I get dressed, I'm getting all my shoes, I'm going down to the garden. Yo. And the walk down there has its own virtues. Like you might just see a little bird in bird shoes. Like a bee walker, walker, follow me down to my garden.
Down. Follow me down.
watch us fool. And we are kissing in a fistful of fragments falling down. I throw them up and I watch them hit the ground like snow. Amputated dimension of the physical. Melting image without sound. Park Avenue, 838, waving to my best friend. Like a soldier at the gate of tears. Feels like it's been 10 years. Has it only been 2 years? 2 years feels like forever. But I know you with that look and you call, we come together. Even without speaking, you sang for me. You sang for me. To you every day. It took you in when I pushed you away. It was your lover, it was your mother. And there is so much that I wish I could have been for you somehow. But we don't need to talk about that now. We're finally in a good place, meeting face to face. On an airplane, 2070. Grand Canyon, but I can see I'm headed home from somewhere that I can't be. Remembering everything, I follow you forever. Even without looking, you call, we come together. Even without speaking, I can tell what you are thinking. Even without saying, we dream our dreams together. Even without laying in the same bed, and you say.
That was Los Angeles by Big Thief, and before that was P Waka Waka by Phased on a Pony. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last week, Auckland Council voted to take draft changes to the Auckland Unitary Plan to consultation, which would see increased housing density, particularly around public transport networks. Housing Minister Chris Bishop has spoken positively of the move and says it will provide an alternative for the government's goal of 2 million new homes in Auckland, as well as emphasising how the move can operate alongside public transport developments. I spoke to Senior Lecturer at the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, Bill Mackay, about the changes and what they will mean for housing in Auckland. How does the Auckland Unitary Plan work and what exactly are these changes?
The Auckland Unitary Plan already aimed to go up rather than out, you know, to provide more density rather than more suburban sprawl. But what we're really seeing here is a Labor government policy, the National Policy Statement on Urban Development, and the government brought that in, and that's basically saying that where you've got transport hubs or good bus routes, then we should have more apartment buildings, 5, 6, 7 stories high along there.
And what does increased housing density mean for Auckland?
I think it does two things. We can build more dwellings more cheaply. And the more dwellings we've got, the more we can bring down the cost of the average dwelling. But the second thing that all this apartment development will do is it will provide an alternative to the suburban house, which, you know, not everyone aspires to have a house in the suburbs in the big family. So, you know, there are a couple of things going on there. Plus, I guess a third thing would be that by building along good transport routes, we're actually kind of making a contribution to the climate and sustainability by more people being able to get on buses and public transport rather than use cars.
You touched on it there, but Minister Chris Bishop talked about especially the City Rail Link coming into play and just general public transport. How do these changes sort of shape this relationship between housing and public transport going forward in Auckland?
Yeah, two different ways, really. So if you've got a good bus route, such as on many of our main arteries, Dominion Road, Sandringham Road, New North Road, Great North Road, you mainly have buses going along there, and the development that we find internationally that works best there is kind of medium rise, so 3, 4, 5 stories high. But where we have train stations, and they're reasonably far apart, then we find that the best sort of development that we could do there would be much more high rise, so 10 stories, 12 stories, that sort of thing. A bit like the train station in Newmarket, and you've got some, you know, really dense apartment development around that. So that's the aim around train stations, as slightly different from bus routes.
And with all of this in mind, how will these changes affect Aucklanders, both in terms of that development and the housing density, but also quality of life?
I think that actually we've got some very bad examples of apartment building in town. If you look at the apartments that were done early on, Nelson Street, Hobson Street, there are some pretty terrible ones there, but we've learned to do apartment buildings a lot better. And if you look at a lot of the medium density apartment buildings that developers such as Ockham are doing, they've done about 22 now, they're much better quality. And you can, we're actually providing drier, more affordable, you know, warmer housing close to where people can get on public transport and closer to where they live, work and play.
I mean, you did mention it there at the end there, but aside from the climate, why is it so important that we are giving Aucklanders access to public transport networks?
Apart from climate change and sustainability issues, I take the bus a lot. I also have a car, but kind of public transport, it needs to be cheaper. It's more expensive than you think, and it needs to be more reliable. That's one of the crucial things. But in the end, we kind of hope that by moving to public transport, it's more affordable for people to get around. And, you know, that's one of the big things about the City Rail Link.
And are these changes a statement of intent from the council of where we're going with urban planning in the future?
Yeah, very much. And there's been a bit of debate about this 2 million homes figure. And there are a couple of reasons why we've got that 2 million homes figure. But one of them is just because you upzone a lot of land and you say we can build higher and more dense here doesn't mean it's going to happen. So coming up with plans like this is a bit like running a bath. You turn the tap on, so and then you come back, you know, in several years and you check, you know, just like you would with a bath, checking the kind of heat and how much water. So plans are about turning the tap on for more density, not necessarily saying it will happen right here.
And what more along these lines should we be seeing from the council and the central government?
I think I support this strategy here, and like I say, actually it is a sneaky little example of this national government picking up on something that the former Labor government that was a good idea and is working. So hopefully we can continue this kind of approach. One other thing that when National was in opposition, they agreed on a thing called medium density residential standards. And that was, that you may have heard of it, you can build almost anywhere in Auckland, three stories high and three dwellings there. But what we found with that is it's too scattershot. And you got, you know, three dwellings, three stories high in the middle of kind of suburbia, remote from public transport, all of that kind of thing. So, kind of, you know, there's pros and cons.
That was the University of Auckland's Bill Mackay on the Council's changes to housing density in the Auckland Unitary Plan.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Otago's Leah Watkins, Bird New Zealand's Natalie Forsdick, Birdcare Aotearoa's Rashi Parker, and the University of Auckland's Bill Mackay. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana, thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.